Mr. McCutcheon.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Michael McCutcheon. I represent Kendrick Latham in this appeal. This appeal came before the Court on a certificate of appealability issued by Judge Ripple last July. The certificate of appealability asked us to address two issues, one being the timeliness of the petitioner's Section 2255 motion, and in addition, whether or not Mr. Latham was denied effective assistance of counsel in his criminal trial. With regard to the first issue, Mr. Latham wins this appeal for three separate reasons. The first being that this Court's June 9, 2003 order, which denied his request to withdraw his consent to the dismissal of his direct appeal, was in and of itself appealable to the United States Supreme Court. If that is true...
I assume it's not appealable.
Well, Your Honor, he could have petitioned for a writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court.
Does one need to worry about whether one could file a petition from the June 9 order? Could a petition have been filed from the May 1st order itself?
Your Honor, there is some suggestion from the district courts, and in particular...
I'm not asking about suggestions from the district court. I'm asking about your position. Is it your position that a petition for certiorari could have been filed to contest the disposition of May 1?
No, Your Honor, we have not argued that.
I'm not asking whether you have argued that.
Okay.
I'm asking whether you think it could have been.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it could have been.
Why not?
Well, because it wouldn't seem that the Court had made any decision necessarily at May 1 outside
of the appeal.
On the request of the petitioner, Your Honor, which...
Suppose the petitioner went to the Supreme Court and said, the attorney forged my signature to this motion.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? I assume that would be reviewable in the Supreme Court.
It may very well be, and it seems Your Honor thinks it may have been.
See, the reason I'm asking this question, maybe we don't need to reach it in this case, is that my understanding of where we are left after cases like Hone against the United States, which deal with getting review of decisions not to issue certificates of appealability, is that the only question for review by the Supreme Court is whether the case ever got to be in the Court of Appeals.
That's what the United States Court of Appeals dealt with in Hone, yes, Your Honor.
In what?
In the Hone opinion that you had just mentioned, Your Honor.
Right, that's the question in the Supreme Court. So filing a notice of appeal puts a case in the Court of Appeals. And then, of course, dismissing the notice of appeal puts it out again. And if you think it was put out wrongly, the logical implication is that you can seek certiorari.
Yes, Your Honor. And that is the situation that this Court presents, is Mr. Latham's contention that his case was wrongly taken out of the Court of Appeals when he voluntarily dismissed it as an attorney filed a motion to dismiss without him truly understanding or at least believing that he had been misled as to the gravity of that.
That is his argument, that the notice of dismissal was not voluntary.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's why I'm asking whether the real issue in this case isn't whether certiorari could have been sought from the order of May 1. If that was the kind of issue from which certiorari could be sought, then it seems to me that the June 9 order is effectively the denial of reconsideration, and it's all straightforward. But, of course, from your perspective, it doesn't even matter whether that's true.
Your Honor, if the Court believes that the order of May 1 was appealable to the Supreme, could have sought cert in the Supreme Court of the United States,
it was a decision of a case that was in the Court of Appeals. And maybe it's not clear to you. Maybe it's not clear to, maybe it won't be clear to Mr. Carr. I just want to be clear why I'm asking this question. 1254 is a very unusual statute because it does not require a decision of the Court of Appeals. You can seek certiorari before judgment. All the case has to be is in the Court of Appeals. It doesn't require an adverse decision, right? It doesn't require that you make an argument to the Court of Appeals that it rejects. You can seek certiorari from a case you won in the Court of Appeals, and that's been done. The Solicitor General occasionally wins in the Court of Appeals and asks the Supreme Court to review it because he thinks the issue is important. So given the unusual status of 1254, the fact that it was the defendant who asked that the appeal be dismissed,
yes,
seems to me, at least, not a reason why certiorari couldn't be sought. 1254 is a very weird statute.
Yeah, I would agree. In my opinion, this is the first time I've looked at it in this case, Your Honor, that it is a weird statute, and I could find no reason why from our perspective when we were looking at it in the briefs, that the June 9th order couldn't have been appealed. And I would tend to agree with Your Honor now, having heard your reasoning, that the May 1 order could have been appealed as well. In either instance, Your Honor, if you agree with that, and it seems that you do, that Latham would have been therefore entitled to 90 days thereafter, whether it be September 1 in the case of the May 1 order, if it was appealable from then, or the June 9th order on September 8, 2003. His Section 2255 petition was thereafter timely filed because he filed it on May 7, 2004, which would have been 4 months in advance of either one of those dates. Your Honor, the District Court's reliance on the United States versus Sylvester, I think, was erroneous, because not only did the United States versus Sylvester not deal with a circumstance in which the defendant had challenged the voluntariness of his dismissal, but there was no order that followed it. And in that instance, the case, by holding that District Court would therefore have, the Third Circuit's unpublished opinion thereafter that said it would have had no jurisdiction to consider it was erroneous. Turning to the second argument, and in the alternative, if this Court doesn't believe that Clay applies, it should treat Mr. Latham's May 12, 2003 motion to reconsider the voluntary dismissal of his appeal as the functional equivalent of a Rule 40 petition for panel rehearing. Your Honor, Mr. Latham was proceeding pro se at the time when that motion was filed. Attorneys may have styled it something differently, but nevertheless it had what seems to be the same effect. This Court, on receiving it, asked for briefing from Mr. Latham's appellate counsel to test the allegations that he had presented in the May 12th order, and thereafter ruled on June 9th, foreclosing any opportunity for direct appeal, at least within the Seventh Circuit. If that's the case, Your Honor, then it should have been treated as the functional equivalent of a motion for panel rehearing, which Your Honors know stays the issuance of the mandate and thereafter prevents the judgment from being final until there's a decision on the motion for panel rehearing, which occurs usually within 7 days after that. Your Honors, I see that I'm cutting into my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve some of that, but I would just note that if Your Honors rule in Mr. Latham's favor on the timeliness issue, the Court should remand this case to the District Court for a full hearing on the merits of what he had presented in his Section 2255 motion. And, Your Honors, I ask simply that that's what you do in this instance. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCutcheon. Mr. Carr.
Obviously.
Well, Mr. Carr, you heard my problem. Section 1254 is a seriously weird statute, and if it allowed 60 days to petition even for review of a judgment you asked the Court of Appeals to enter, presumably this is a timely petition.
And brighter people than I will probably decide that. Neither one of us briefed the issue. It appears to me that we've pretty much taken the position, and we do take the position, that once he signed that waiver of appeal and the court dismissed it, the appellate court lost jurisdiction. It was not in the Court of Appeals. Under Barrow versus Falk, he had
fine,
no...
But so what? The question is not whether the Court of Appeals relinquished its jurisdiction on May 1, but whether it was ever in the Court of Appeals. That's why I raised phone. Somebody files a notice of appeal. The question then arises in a collateral attack. Mm-hmm. The prisoner then needs a certificate of appealability. And if the Court of Appeals says none will issue, the case goes out of the Court of Appeals right then. But the Supreme Court said in Hone it doesn't make any difference that it was first in and then out. All that was necessary for review in the Supreme Court, Hone says, is that it ever have been in.
Okay.
So on the Hone approach, all that's necessary is that it ever have been in the Court of Appeals.
I accept if that's the interpretation, then the government's got problems.
Do you have a response to Hone?
Well, I have a response factually to this case. I mean, I know that it was in the Court of Appeals, and I understand what the court just said, but I also know that there was a waiver, and waivers are enforceable. And under Rule...
That's a different question. That's to say, if he filed a petition for a writ of certiorari from the May 1 decision or the June 9, the Solicitor General would file a response saying there was a waiver of a right to appeal, please deny the petition. And the Supreme Court almost certainly would. But that doesn't, you know, that doesn't respond to the timing question. The only question for timing is when did the time to seek certiorari expire? That's Jones. And then you add a year to that. So we don't need to know whether he could get certiorari successfully. Almost certainly not, one would think. But only whether the case was in the Court of Appeals so that there's this 60-day time to seek it.
Technically, I can't argue with that. I can only say that I can't believe that a system that would set up, and that's Circuit Rule 51, or Rule 51, would set up a procedure.
Well, look, let me put it differently. Suppose there's a plea bargain, and the defendant signs a waiver of any right to appeal in the plea bargain. And not only that, he signs it in blood, and Mephistopheles is present in the courtroom, right? This is a real contract, right? It says, and I agree to be dragged off to hell if I violate this contract. And he then violates the contract. He files a notice of appeal. Court of Appeals dismisses the appeal on the basis of the waiver. When does the time to file a collateral attack run?
The time would run 90 days under Clay. However,
yeah, Clay would govern that, so I don't see why Clay doesn't govern this.
Do so would be to completely ignore the purpose for extending for 90 days the period for filing one of these 2255s. When there is no possibility of success, how can one reasonably argue that the...
Then you have to answer my question about the waiver before the appeal, the waiver with Mephistopheles in the courtroom. You have to answer that by saying... The time to file a collateral review runs from the day of the sentence in the district court because any appeal is irrelevant. The proceeding has ended then. But you answered my question, I think, correctly by saying it's the time from when the Court of Appeals dismisses the appeal plus the time allowed by the Supreme Court's rules, see Clay. These positions seem to me have to be treated identically.
It seems to me, Judge, and I understand what you're saying, but it seems to me that you cannot ignore the purpose for the Clay 90-day extension for filing cert, which was to allow for somebody with some kind of a legitimate argument to proceed with the 2255. When, in effect, you have a waiver and an affirmative statement from the defendant, it's on page 7 of our brief and our appendix, page 5, when you have a statement that says... page 5 and page 8, page 7. I have been informed of my attorney's intention to move to dismiss my appeal. I concur in my attorney's decision and hereby waive all rights to object or raise any points on appeal. Certainly that flies in the face of the Clay analogy, which gives 90 days for bringing some appeal, when you're, in essence, telling everybody that you're ending the litigation. I mean, that's what Circuit Rule 51 is all about. That's what... the appendix is to affirmatively...
We allow somebody who's waived his appeal in the district court as part of a plea bargain to appeal if what he says is the whole plea bargain was involuntary.
But
you
I think
know,
you have
I've
to...
I've signed this waiver because somebody held a gun to my head or they lied to me.
Clearly.
Right? You can set aside waivers that are embedded in involuntary documents. And that's why I'm sure you're correct that if a guy signs the waiver in the district court and appeals, the time will be calculated under Clay from when this court dismisses the appeal plus time to seek certiorari and not from the end of the district court proceeding. I have difficulty understanding why it's different here where the defendant makes the functionally identical claim that this thing filed on May 1 was involuntary. Whether he's right or wrong shouldn't affect the calculation of the time.
I think your 1254 analysis may be unassailable, but it's not taking into consideration the purpose of Clay, which was to extend the 90 days when there is legitimately an issue on appeal, and there is not.
I just don't think Clay had a purpose. The statute is what says a year from the final decision, including the expiration of the time to seek review, etc. Right? Now, Congress may or may not have been intelligent in phrasing it that way, but there we are.
Well, and as I've indicated before, if that's where we are, then the government loses. Again, I think that the voluntary dismissal by the defendant should be considered. I can't imagine that when we're talking about 1254 and interpreting that statute, that it would be interpreted in such a way.
Think about our last case. Suppose we have the last case, the previous case is the way to put it. There's a conflict among the circuits about the application of the attempted robbery, attempted force and intimidation subsection. There'll be a conflict no matter what we do. You think the Solicitor General, suppose we decided in the government's favor, think the Solicitor General could file a petition for certiorari from that?
Yes.
Yes. So it's established, and this is what happened in Chadha and a couple other cases I could tell you.
Ample, Your Honor.
The prevailing parties can seek certiorari from a decision of the Court of Appeals doing exactly what they asked the Court of Appeals to do.
But you don't have one of those parties in your example signing a waiver saying they won't appeal anything. And that's what your waiver, that's what Appendix 3, which is required under Rule 51F, says. He says he's not going to appeal it. So while I can't argue with your 1254 analogy, applying that as some kind of a extension in the 2255 context seems to be at odds with the circuit's rule as well as your appendix informed.
As I said, 2254 is a seriously weird statute.
Oh, there was a lot more here that I thought was weird than just that, and obviously we felt like that the waiver was enforceable. So I understand what the court is saying. We think that the waiver is forcible. I'd also indicate that we'd also point out that we think that obviously the circuit has not found an occasion when equitable tolling would apply, assuming that you use the May 1st date. And it seems to me that Your Honor is not inclined to interpret it that way from this point. But if by chance the court interprets it a different way, it seems to me that equitable tolling would not apply, has not applied in this circuit, and that even then that Bowles may have some application here. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions?
All right.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. McCutcheon?
I don't want to spend any more of my time that's limited here just discussing the Clay exception. But in the event that either of the other two justices on the court here have any doubt in their mind as to the applicability of it.
Or that I come to my senses.
Excuse me. Or that you come to your senses, Your Honor.
That was Mr. Carr's line, waiting for me to wake up from a bad dream.
I would simply reiterate that we provided two alternative grounds that are equally based in reason and in the law, and that Your Honor should allow Mr. Latham to return to the district court for a full evidentiary hearing under Section 2255, Paragraph 2. That is all we've asked Your Honors to do, and that's all I ask today.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. McCutcheon. We appreciate your willingness to take this case and the assistance you've been to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow.